Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Couching at the Door by D.K. Broster. The first inkling which Augustine Marchant had of the matter was one fine summer morning, about 3 weeks after his visit to Prague, that is to say, in June 1898. He was reclining, as his custom was when writing his poetry, on the very comfortable sofa in his library at Abbot's Mending, near the French windows, one of which was open to the garden. Pausing for inspiration, he was nearly at the end of his poem, Salutation to All Unbeliefs. He let his eyes wander round the beautifully appointed room, with its cloisonné and satsuma, Boulle and first editions, and then allowed them to stray toward the sunlight outside. And so between the edge of the costly Herat carpet and the sill of the open window across the strip of polished oak flooring, he observed what he took to be a small piece of dark fluff blowing in the draft, and instantly made a note to speak to his housekeeper about the parlor maid. There was slackness somewhere, and in Augustine Marchant's house, no one was allowed to be slack but himself. There had been a time when the poet would not for a moment have been received, as he was now, in country and even county society. Those days, even before the advent of the Yellow Book and the Savoy, when he had lived in London, writing the plays and poems which had so startled and shocked all but the decadent and the advanced. Pomegranates of Sin, Queen Theodora and Queen Marozia, The Knights of the Tour de Nesse, Amour Cyprocase, and the rest. But when, as the 90s began to wane, he inherited Abbot's Mending from a distant cousin and came to live there, being then at the height of an almost international reputation, Wiltshire society at first tolerated him for his kinship with the late Lord Mending, and then, placated by the excellence of his dinners, and further mollified by the patent staidness of his private life, decided that, in his personal conduct at any rate, he must have turned over a new leaf. Perhaps, indeed, he had never been as bad as he was painted, and if his writings continued to be no less scandalously free and free-thinking than before, and indeed to be just as rigidly kept out of the hands of daughters, well, no country gentleman in the neighborhood was obliged to read them. And indeed, Augustine Marchant, in his 51st year, was too keenly alive to the value of the good opinion of county society to risk shocking it by any overt doings of his. He kept his license for his pen when he went abroad, as he did at least twice a year, but that was another matter altogether. The nose of Mrs. Grundy was not sharp enough to smell at his occupations in Warsaw or Berlin or Naples. Her eyes, long-sighted enough to discern what kind of society he frequented, even so near home as Paris. At Abbot's Mending, his reputation for being wicked was fast declining into just enough of a sensation to tilitate a croquet party. He had charming manners, could be witty at moments, though he could not keep it up, still retained his high-sitting locks by means of hair restorers, wore his excellently cut velvet coats and flowing ties with just the right air, half poet, half man of the world, and really had, at Abbot's Mending, no dark secret to hide beyond the fact, sedulously concealed by him for 25 years, that he had never been Christian Augustine. Between Augustus and Augustine, what a gulf! But he had crossed it, and his French poems, which had to be smuggled into his native land, were signed Augustin, Augustin de Marchant. Removing his gaze from the objectionable evidence of domestic carelessness upon the floor, Mr. Marchant now fixed it meditatively upon the ruby set end of the gold pencil which he was using. Rosalind Ward, his publishers, were about to bring out an edition deluxe of Queen Theodora and Queen Marozia, with illustrations by hitherto unknown young artists, if they were not too daring. It would be a sumptuous affair in a limited edition. And as he thought of this, the remembrance of his recent stay in Prague returned to the poet. He smiled to himself, as a man smiles when he looks at a rare wine and thought, yes, if these blunt-witted Pharisees in round Abbot's Meeting only knew. It was a good thing that the upholders of British petty morality were seldom great travelers, a dispensation of providence. Twiddling his gold pencil between plump fingers, Augustine Marchant returned to his ode, weighing one epitaph against another. Except in summer, he was no advocate of open windows, and even in summer he considered that to get the most out of that delicate and precious instrument, his brain, his feet must always be kept thoroughly warm. He had therefore cast over them, before settling into a semi-reclining position, a beautiful rose-colored Indian sari of the purest and thickest silk, leaving the ends trailing on the floor. And he became aware, with surprise and annoyance, that the piece of brown fluff, or whatever it was down there, traveling in the draft from the window, had reached the nearest end of the sari, and was now impelled by the same current traveling up it. The master of Abbot's Meeting reached out for the silver handbell on the table by his side. There must be more breeze coming in than he had realized, and he might take cold, a catastrophe against which he guarded himself as against the plague. Then he saw that the upward progress of the dark blot, it was about the size of a farthing, could not by any possibility be assigned to any other agency than its own. It was climbing up. Some horrible insect, plainly some disgusting kind of almost legless and very hairy spider, round and vague in outline. The poet sat up and shook the sari violently. When he looked again, the invader was gone. Somewhere it must still be. The idea perturbed him, and he decided to take his writing out to the summer house and give orders later that the library was to be thoroughly swept out. Ah, it was good to be out of doors, and in a pleasant, so delightfully laid out, so exquisitely kept as his. In the basin of the fountain, the sea nymphs of rosy-veined marble clustered around a Thetis as beautiful as Aphrodite herself. The lightest and featheriest of acacia trees swayed near. And as the owner of all this went past over the wheatless turf, he repeated snatches of relaying to himself about Sauvelt's, Chaudieu, and sang Lautstickstas. Then turning his head to look back at the fountain, he became aware of a little dark brown object, about the size of a halfpenny, running toward him over the velvet smooth sward. He believed afterward that he must first have had a glimpse of the truth at that instant in the garden, or he would not have acted so instinctively as he did and so promptly. For a moment later, he was standing at the edge of the basin of Thetis, his face blanched in the sunshine, his hand firmly clenched. Inside that closed hand, something feather-soft pulsated, holding back as best he could the disgust and the somewhat more which clutched at him. Augustine Marchant stooped and plunged his whole fist into the bubbling water and let the stream of the fountain whirl away what he had picked up. Then, with uncertain steps, he went and sat down on the nearest seat and shut his eyes. After a while, he took out his lawn handkerchief and carefully dried his hand with the intaglio ring, dried it, and then looked curiously at the palm. I did not know I had so much courage. He was thinking, so much courage and good sense. It would doubtless drown very quickly. Burroughs, his butler, was coming over the lawn. Mr. and Mrs. Morrison have arrived, sir. Ah, yes, I had forgotten for the moment. Augustine Marchant got up and walked towards the house and his guests, throwing back his shoulders and practicing his famous enigmatic smile, for Mrs. Morrison was a woman worth impressing. But what had it been exactly? Why, just what it had looked, a tuft of fur blowing over the grass, a tuft of fur. Sheer imagination that had moved in his closed hand with a life of its own, Then why had he shut his eyes as he stooped and made a grab at it? Thank God. Thank God. It was nothing now but a drenched smear swirling round the nymphs of Thetis. Ah, dear lady, you must forgive me. Unpardonable of me not to be in to receive you. He was in the drawing room now, fragrant with its banks of hothouse flowers, bending over the hand of the fashionably attired guest on the sofa, with a flyaway hat perched at a rakish angle on her gold-brown hair. "Your man told us that you were riding in the garden," said her goggle-eyed husband reverentially. "It is we that ought not to be interrupting your rendezvous with a muse," returned Mrs. Morrison, in her sweet high voice, terrible to bring you from such company into that of mere visitors. Running his hand through his carefully tended locks, the man replied, "Between a visit from the muse and one from beauty's self, no true poet could hesitate. Moreover, luncheon awaits us, and I trust it is a good one." He liked faintly to shock fair admirers by admitting that he cared for the pleasures of the table. It was quite safe to do so, since none of them had sufficient acumen to see that it was true. The luncheon was excellent, for Augustine kept an admirable cook. Afterward, he showed his guests over the library. Yes, even though it had not received the sweeping, which would not be necessary now, and round the gardens and in the summer house was prevailed upon to read from one of his books. And Mrs. Francis, nowadays Francesca Morrison, was thereafter able to recount to envious friends how the poet himself had read her stanza after stanza from that most daring poem of his, and how poor Fred, fanning himself meanwhile with his straw hat, not from the torridity of the verse, but because of the afternoon heat, said afterward that he had not understood a single word. A good thing, perhaps. When they had gone, Augustine Marchant reflected rather cynically, "All that was just so much bunkum when I wrote it." For 10 years ago, in spite of those audacious, glowing verses, he was an ignorant neophyte. Of course, since then, he smiled, a private, sly, self-satisfied smile. It was certainly pleasant to know oneself no longer a fraud. Returning to the summer house to fetch his poems, he saw what he took to be Mrs. Morrison's fur boa lying on the floor, just by the basket chair which she had occupied. Odd of her not to have missed it on departure, a tribute to his verses, perhaps. His housekeeper must send it after her by post. But just at that moment, his head gardener approached, desiring some instructions. And when the matter was settled, and Augustine Marchant turned once more to enter the summer house, he found that he'd been mistaken about the drop boa, for there was nothing on the floor. Besides, he remembered now that Mrs. Morrison's boa had been a rope of gray feathers, not a dark fur. As he took up the book he had been reading, he asked himself lazily, what could have led him to imagine a woman's boa there at all, much less a fur one? Suddenly, he knew why. A lattice in the house of memory had opened, and he remained rigid, staring out at the jets, the fountain, rising and falling in the afternoon sun. Yes, of that glamorous, wonderful, abominable night in Prague, the part he least wished to recall was connected, incidentally but undeniably, with a fur boa, a long boa of dark fur. He had to go up to town next day to dinner in his honor. There and then he decided to go up that same night by a late train, a most unusual proceeding and most disturbing to his valet, who knew that it was doubtful whether he would at such short notice procure him a first-class carriage to himself. However, Augustine Marchant went, and even to the man's amazement, deliberately chose a compartment with another occupant when he might, after all, have had an empty one. The dinner was brilliant. Augustine had never spoken better. Next day he went round to the little street not far from the British Museum, where he found Lawrence Story, his new illustrator, working feverishly at his drawings for Queen Theodora and Queen Marzoia. And quite overwhelmed at the honor of a personal visit, Augustine was very kind to him, and while offering a few criticisms, highly praised his delineation of those two Messalinas of 10th century Rome, their long, supple hands, their heavy eyes, their full, almost repellent mouths. Story had followed the same type for mother and daughter, but with a subtle difference. They were certainly two most evil women, especially the younger, he observed ingeniously. But I suppose that, from an artistic point of view, that doesn't matter nowadays. Augustine smoked one of his special cigarettes, made a delicate little gesture. My dear fellow, art has nothing whatever to do with what is called morality. Happily, we know that at last. Show me how you thought of depicting the scene where Marozia orders the execution of her mother's papal paramour. Good. Very good. Yes, the lines there. Even the fall of that loose sleeve from the extended arm expressed with clarity what I had in mind. You have great gifts. I've tried to make her look wicked, said the young man, reddening with pleasure, but, he added deprecatingly, it is very hard for a ridiculously inexperienced person like myself to have the right artistic vision. For to you, Mr. Marchant, who have penetrated into such wonderful arcana of the forbidden, it would be foolish to pretend to be other than I am. How do you know that I have penetrated into any such arcana? Inquired the poet, half shutting his eyes and looking, though not to the almost worshipping gaze of a young Story, like a great cat being stroked. Why, one has only to read you. You must come down and stay with me soon, were Augustin Marchant's parting words. He would give the boy a few days good living, for which he would be none the worse. Let him drink some decent wine. How soon do you think you will be able to finish the rough sketches for the rest and the designs for the coup de lamp? A fortnight or 3 weeks? Good. I shall look to see you then. Goodbye, my dear fellow. I am very, very much pleased with what you have shown me. The worst of going up to London from the country was that one was apt to catch a cold in town. When he got back, Augustin Marchant was almost sure that this misfortune had befallen him. So he ordered a fire in his bedroom, despite the season, and consumed a recherché little supper in seclusion. And as the cold turned out to have been imaginary, he was very comfortable sitting there in his silken dressing gown, toasting his toes and holding up a glass of golden Tokay to the flames. Really, Theodora and Marozia would make as much sensation when it came out with these illustrations as when it first appeared. All at once, he set down the glass. Not far away on his left sat a big cheval mirror like a woman's, in which a good portion of the bed behind him was reflected. And in this mirror, he had just seen the valance of the bed move. There could be no draft to speak of in this warm room. He never allowed a cat in the house, and it was quite impossible that there should be a rat about. If, after all, some stray cat should have got in, it must be ejected at once. Augustine hitched round his chair to look at the actual bed hanging. Yes, the topaz-hued silk valance again swung very slightly outward as though if it were being pushed. Augustine bent forward to the bell pull to summon his valet. Then the flask of Tokay rolled over on the table as he leaped from his chair. Instead, something like a huge dark caterpillar was emerging very slowly from under his bed, moving as a caterpillar moves with undulations running over it. Where its head should have been was merely a tapering and smaller than the rest of it, but of like substance. It was a dark fur boa. Augustin Marchant felt that he screamed, but he could not have done so, for his tongue clave to the roof of his mouth. He merely stood staring, staring, all the blood gone from his heart. Still very slowly, the thing continued to creep out from under the valance, waving that eyeless tapering end to and fro, as though uncertain where to proceed. I am going mad, thought Augustin, and with a revulsion, no, it can't be. It's a real snake of some kind. That could be dealt with. He snatched up the poker as the boa thing, still swaying, the head which was no head, kept pouring steadily out from under the lifted yellow frill until quite 3 feet were clear of the bed. Then he fell upon it furiously with blow after blow. But they had no effect on the furry, spineless thing. It merely gave under them and rippled up in another place. Augustin hit the bed, the floor, at last, really screaming. He threw down his weapon and fell upon the thick, hairy rope with both hands, crushing it together into a mass. There was little of any resistance in it. Hurled it into the fire, and panting, kept it down with shovel and tongs. The flames licked up instantly, and with a roar, made short work of it, though there seemed to be some slight effort to escape, which was perhaps only the effect of the heat. A moment later, there was a very strong smell of burnt hair, and that was all. Augustin Marchant seized the fallen flask of Tokay and drained from its mouth what little was left in the bottom. Staggering to the bed, he flung himself upon it and buried his face in the pillows, even heaping them over his head, as if he could thus stifle the memory of what he had seen. He kept his bed next morning. The supposed cold afforded a good pretext. Long before the maid came in to relay the fire, he had crawled out to make sure that there was no traces left of what he had burnt there. There was none. A nightmare could not have left a trace, he told himself, but well he knew that it was not a nightmare. And now he could think of nothing but that room in Prague and the long fur boa of the woman. Some deportment of his mind, he supposed, must have projected that thing scarcely noticed at the time, scarcely remembered, into the present and the here. It was terrible to think that one's mind possessed such dark, unknown powers, but not so terrible as if the apparition had been endowed with an entirely separate objective existence. In a day or two, he would consult his doctor and ask him to give him a tonic. But, expostulated as uncomfortably lucid part of his brain, you are trying to run with a hare and hunt with the hounds. Is it not better to believe that the thing had an objective existence, for you have burnt it to nothing? Well and good. But if it merely was a projection from your own mind, what is to prevent it from reappearing like the phoenix from ashes? There seemed no answer to that, save in an attempt to persuade himself that he had been feverish last night. Work was the best antidote. So Augustin Marchant rose and was surprisingly delighted to find the atmosphere of his study unusually soothing and inspiring, and that day, against all expectation, salutation to all unbeliefs was completed by some stanza with which he was not too ill-pleased, realizing nevertheless that he should be glad of company that evening. He had earlier sent round a note to a local solicitor, a good fellow, to come and dine with him, play a game of billiards with a lawyer afterwards, and retire to bed with some vintage port and a good stiff whiskey and soda with scarcely a thought of the visitant of the previous night. He woke at that hour when the thrushes in early summer punctually greet the new day, 3 o'clock. They were greeting it vociferously, and Augustin Marchant was annoyed with their enthusiasm. His golden damask window curtains kept out all but a glimmer of the new day, yet as, lying upon his back, the poet opened his eyes for a moment. His only half-awakened sense of vision reported something swinging to and fro in the dimness, like a pendulum of rope. It was indistinct, but seemed to be hanging from the tester of the bed, and wide awake in an instant, with an unspeakable anguish of premonition tearing through him, he felt, next moment, a light thud on the coverlet about the level of his knees. Something had arrived on the bed, and Augustin Marchant neither shrieked nor leaped from his bed. He could not. Yet now that his eyes were grown used to the twilight of the room, he saw it clearly. The fur rope, which he had burnt to extinction 2 nights ago, dark and shiny as before, rippling with a gentle movement as it coiled itself neatly together in the place where it had struck the bed and subsided there in a symmetrical round with only that tapering end, a little raised and, as it were, looking at him. Only eyeless and featureless, it could not look. One thought of disgusted relief that it was not at any rate going to attack him, and Augustin Marchant fainted. Yet his swoon must have merged into sleep, for he woke in a more or less ordinary fashion to find his man placing his early tea tray beside him and inquiring when he should draw his bath. There was nothing on the bed. I shall change my bedroom, thought Augustine to himself, looking at the haggard, fallen-eyed man who faced him in the mirror as he shaved. No, better still, I will go away for a change. Then I shall not have these dreams. I'll go to old Edgar Fortescue for a few days. He begged me again not long ago to come any time. So to the house of the old Masinius he went. He was much too great a man now to be in need of Sir Edgar's patronage. It was homage which he received there, both from hosts and guests. The stay did much to soothe his scarified nerves. Unfortunately, the last day undid the good of all the foregoing ones. Sir Edgar possessed a pretty young wife, his third, and among other charms of his place in Somerset, an apple orchard underplanted with flowers, and in the cool of the evening Augustine walked there with his host and hostess, almost as if he were the Almighty with the dwellers in Eden. Presently they sat down upon a rustic seat, but a very comfortable one, under the shade of the apple boughs, amid the incongruous but pleasant parterres. "You have come at the wrong season for these apple trees, Marchant," observed Sir Edgar, after a while taking out his cigar. "Blossom time or apple time, they are showy at either, in spite of the underplanting. What is attracting you on that tree? A tit? We have all kinds here, pretty, destructive little beggars." "I did not know that I was looking. It's nothing, thinking of something else," stammered the poet. Surely he had been mistaken in thinking that he had seen a sinuous, dark, furry thing undulating like a caterpillar down the stem of that particular apple tree at a few yards' distance. Talk went on, even his. There was safety in it. It was only the breeze which faintly rustled the bed of heliotrope behind the seat. Augustine wanted desperately to get up and leave the orchard, but neither Sir Edgar nor his wife seemed disposed to move, and so the poet remained at his end of the seat, his left hand playing nervously with a long bend of grass which had escaped the scythe. All at once he felt a tickling sensation on the back of his hand, looked down, and saw the featureless snout of fur protruding upward from underneath the rustic bench and sweeping itself backward and forward against his hand with a movement which was almost caressing. He was on his feet in a flash. "Do you mind if I go in?" he asked abruptly. "I'm not feeling very well." If the thing could follow him, it was of no use to go away. He returned to Abbot's Meeting, looking so much the worse for his change of air that Burroughs expressed a respectful hope that he was not indisposed. And almost the first thing that occurred when Augustine sat down at his writing table to attend to his correspondence was the unwinding of itself from one of its curved legs of a soft brown oscillating serpent, which slowly waved an end at him as if in welcome. In welcome. Yes, that was it. The creature, incredible though it was, the creature seemed glad to see him. Standing at the other end of the room, his hands pressed over his eyes, for it was the use of attempting to hurt or destroy it, Augustine Marchant thought, shuddering, that, like a witch's cat, a familiar would not presumably be ill-disposed towards its master. Its master. Oh, God. The hysteria which he had been trying to keep down began to mount uncontrollably when, removing his hand, Augustine glanced up again towards his writing table and saw that the boa had coiled itself in his chair and was sweeping its end to and fro over the back somewhat in a way that a cat, purring meanwhile, rubs itself against furniture or a human leg in real or simulated affection. Go away from there, he suddenly screamed at it, advancing with outstretched hand. The devil's name, get out! To his utter amazement, he was obeyed. The rhythmic movement ceased. The first snake poured itself down out of the chair and writhed over towards the door. Venturing back to his writing table after a moment, Augustine saw it coiled on the threshold, the blind end turned towards him as usual, as though watching, and he began to laugh. What would happen if he rang and someone came? Would the opening door scrape it aside? Would it vanish? Had it, in short, an existence for anyone else but himself? But he dared not make the experiment. He left the room by the French window, feeling that he could never enter the home again, and perhaps, had it not been for the horrible knowledge just acquired that it could follow him, he might easily have gone away for good from Abbot's Meeting and all his treasures and comforts. But of what use would that be? And how would he account for so extraordinary an action? No, he must think and plan while he yet remains sane. To what, then, could he have recourse? The black magic in which he had dabbled with such disastrous consequences might possibly help him. Left to himself, he was but an amateur, but he had a number of books. There was also that other realm, whose boundaries sometimes marched side by side with magic, religion. But how could he pray to a deity in whom he did not believe? Rather pray to the evil which had sent this curse upon him, to show him how to banish it. Yet, since he had deliberately followed what was religion stigmatized as sin, what even the world would label as lust and necromancy, supplication to the dark powers was not likely to deliver him from them. They must somehow be outwitted, circumvented. He kept his grimoires and books of the kind in a locked bookcase in another room. Not in his study. In that room he sat up till midnight. But the spells which he read were useless. Moreover, he did not really believe in them. The irony of the situation was that, in a sense, he had only played at sorcery. It had but lent a spice to sensuality. He wandered wretchedly about the room, dreading at any moment to see his familiar wreathed around some object in it. At last he stopped at a small bookcase which held some old forgotten books of his mother's, Longfellow and Mrs. Herman's, John Halifax, Gentleman, and a good many volumes of sermons and mild essays. And when he looked at that blameless assembly, a cloud seemed to pass over Augustin Marchand's vision, and he saw his mother, gentle and lace-capped as years and years ago. She used to sit, hearing his lesson, in her favorite chair. So she had been everything to him then, the little boy whose soul was not smirched. He called silently to her now, "Mama, Mama, can't you help me? Can't you send this thing away?" When the cloud had passed, he found they had stretched out his hand and removed the big book. Looking at it, he saw that it was her Bible, with Sarah Amelia Marchant on the faded yellowed flyleaf. Her spirit was going to help him. He turned over a page or two, and out of the largest print, there sprang instantly at him. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field. Augustin shuddered and almost put the Bible back, but the conviction that there was help there urged him to go on. He turned a few more pages of Genesis, and his eyes were caught by this verse, which he had never seen before in his life. "And if thou dost well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou dost not well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him." What strange words! What could they possibly mean? Was there light for him in them? "Unto thee shall be his desire." That thing, the loathsome semblance of affection which hung about it, "thou shalt rule over him." It had obeyed him up to a point. Was this book of all others showing him the way to be free? But the meaning of the verse was so obscure. He had not naturally such a thing as a commentary in the house. Yet when he came to think of it, he remembered that some pious and anonymous person, soon after the publication of Pomegranates of Sin, had sent them a Bible in the revised version, with an inscription recommending him to read it. He had it somewhere, though he had always meant to get rid of it. After 20 minutes' search through the sleeping house, he found it in one of the spare bedrooms, but it gave him little enlightenment, for there was scant difference in the rendering, save that for "lieth at the door," this version had couches, and at the margin held an alternative translation for the end of the verse, "and unto thee is its desire, but thou shouldest rule over it." Nevertheless, Augustin Marchand stood after midnight in the silent, sheeted guest bedchamber repeating, "but thou should rule over it." and all at once he thought of a way of escape. Part 2. It was going to be a marvelous experience, staying with Augustin Marchant. Something Lauren's story hoped there would be no other guests at Abbott's Meeting. At other times, he hoped there would be. A tete-a-tete of 4 days with a great poet, could he sustain his share worthily? For Lawrence, despite the remarkable artistic gifts which were finding their first real flowering in these illustrations to Augustine's poems, were still unspoiled, still capable of wonder and admiration, still humble and almost naive. It was still astonishing to him that he, an architect's assistant, should have been snatched away as Ganymede from the Eagle, from the lower world of elevations and drains to serve on Olympus. It was not indeed Augustin Marchant who had first discovered him, but it was Augustin Marchant who was going to make him famous. The telegraph poles flitted past the second-class carriage window, and more than one traveler glanced with a certain envy and admiration at the fair, good-looking young man who diffused such an impression of happiness and candor, and had such a charming smile on his lips. He carried with him a portfolio which he never let out of his reach of his hand. The oldish couple opposite, speculating upon its contents, might have changed their opinion of him had they seen them. But no shadow of the dark weariness of things unlawful rested on Lauren's story. To know Augustin Marchant, to be illustrating his great poem, to have learned from him that art and morality had no kinship, this was to plunge into a new realm of freedom and enlarging experience. Augustin Marchant's poetry, he felt, had already taught his hand what his brain and heart knew nothing of. There was a dog cart to meet him at the station, and in the scented June evening, he was driven with a beating heart past meadows and hayfields to his destination. Mr. Marchant, awaiting him in the hall, was at his most charming. "My dear fellow, are those the drawings? Come, let us lock them away at once in my safe. If you had brought me diamonds, I should not be one quarter so concerned about thieves. And did you have a comfortable journey? I have had you put in the orange room. It is next to mine. There is no one else staying here, but there are a few people coming to dinner to meet you." There was only just time to dress for dinner, so that Lawrence did not get an opportunity to study his host until he saw him seated at the head of the table. Then he was immediately struck by the fact that he looked curiously ill. His face, ordinarily by no means attenuated, seemed to have fallen in. There were dark circles under his eyes, and the perturbed Lawrence observed him as the meal progressed, thought that his manner too seemed strange, and once or twice quite absent-minded. There was one moment when, though the lady on his right was addressing him, he sharply turned his head away and looked down at the side of his chair, just as if he saw something on the floor. Then he apologized, saying that he had a horror of cats, and that sometimes the tiresome animals from the stables. But after that, he continued to entertain his guest in his own inimitable way, and even to the shy Lawrence, the evening proved very pleasant. The three following days were wonderful and exciting to the young artist, days of uninterrupted contact with a mastermind which acknowledged, as the poet himself admitted, none of the petty barriers which man for his own convenience had set up between alleged right and wrong. Lawrence had learned why his host did not look well. It was loss of sleep, the price exacted by inspiration. He had a new poetic drama shaping in his mind which would scale heights that he had not yet attempted. There was almost a touch of fever in the young man's dreams tonight, his last night but one. He had several. First, he was standing by the edge of a sort of mirror, inexpressibly desolate and unfriendly, a place he had never seen in his life, which yet seemed in some way familiar, and something said to him, "You will never go away from here." He was alarmed and woke, but went to sleep again almost immediately, and this time was back, oddly enough, in the church, where in the earliest years he had been taken to service by the aunt who had brought him up, a large church full of pitch pine pews with narrow ledges for hymn books, which ledges he used to lick during the long, dull periods of occultation upon his knees. but most of all, he remembered the window with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, on either side of an apple tree, round whose trunk was a coiled a monstrous snake with a semi-human head. Lawrence had hated and dreaded that window, and because of it, he would never go near an orchard and had no temptation to steal apples. Now he was back in that church again, staring at the window, lit up with some infernal glow from behind. He woke again, little short of terrified. He, a grown man, but again, he went to sleep quite quickly. His third dream had for background, as sometimes happens in nightmares, the very room in which he lay. He dreamed that a door opened in the wall, and in the doorway, quite plain against the light from another room, behind him stood Augustin Marchant in his dressing gown. He was looking down at something on the ground which Lawrence did not see, but his hand was pointing at Lawrence in the bed. And he was saying in a voice of command, "Go to him, do you hear? Go to him. Go to him. Am I not your master?" And Lawrence, who could neither move nor utter a syllable, wondered uneasily what this could be which was thus commanded. But his attention was chiefly focused on Augustin Marchand's face. After he had said these words several times, and apparently without result, a dreadful change came upon it, a look of the most unutterable despair. It seemed visibly to age and wither. He said in a loud, penetrating whisper, "Is there no escape, then?" Covered his ravaged face a moment with his hand, and then went back and softly closed the door. At that, Lawrence woke, but in the morning he had forgotten all three dreams. The tete-a-tete dinner on the last night of his day would have lingered in a gourmet's memory, so that it was a pity the young man did not know in the least what he was eating. At last, there was happening what he had scarcely dared hope for. The great poet of the sensuous was revealing to him some of the unimaginably strange and secret sources of his inspiration. In the shaded rosy candlelight, his elbows on the table, among trails of flowers, he, who was not even a neophyte, listened like a man learning for the first time of some spell or spring which will make him more than mortal. "Yes," said Augustin Marchant after a long pause, "yes, it was a marvelous and undying experience. One that is not given to many. It opened doors, but I despair of doing it justice in mere words." His look was transfigured, almost dreamy. "But she, the woman, how did you?" asked Lawrence Story in a hushed voice. "Oh, the woman," said Augustin, suddenly finishing off his wine. "The woman was only a common streetwalker." A moment or two later, Lawrence was looking at his host wistfully. "But this was in Prague? Prague is a long way off. One does not need to go so far. In reality, even in Paris, one could have that experience in Paris if you knew where to go. And of course, it is necessary to have credentials. I mean that, like all such enlightenments, it has to be kept secret, most secret, from the vulgar minds who lay the restrictions on the finer. That is self-evident." "Of course," said the young man, and sighed deeply. His host looked at him affectionately. "You, my dear Lawrence, I may call you Lawrence, want just that touch of, what shall I call them, les choix cachés, to liberate your immense artistic gifts from the shackles which still bind them. Through that gateway, you would find the possibility of their full fruition. It would fertilize your genius to a still finer blossoming, but you would have scruples, and you are very young." "You know," said Lawrence in a low and trembling tone, "what I feel about your poetry. You know how I ache to lay the best that is in me at your feet. If only I could make my drawings for the two queens more worthy. Already it is an honor which overwhelms me that you should have selected me to do them. But they are not what they should be. I am not sufficiently liberated." Augustin leaned forward on the flower-decked table. His eyes were glowing. "Do you truly desire to be?" The young man nodded, too full of emotions to find his voice. The poet got up, went over to a cabinet in a corner, and unlocked it. Lawrence watched his fine figure in a sort of trance. Then he half rose with an exclamation. What is it? Asked Agustin very sharply, facing Ron. Oh, no, nothing, sir, only that I believe you hate cats, and I thought I saw one, or rather its tail, disappearing into that corner. There is no cat here, said Agustin quickly. His face had become all shiny and mottled, but Lawrence did not notice it. The poet stood a moment looking at the carpet. One might almost have thought that he was gathering resolution to cross it. Then he came swiftly back to the table. Sit down again, he commanded. Have your pocketbook with you. A pocketbook which you never leave about. Good. Then write this in one place and this on another page. Write it small, among other entries is best. Not on a blank page. Write it in Greek characters if you know them. What is it? Asked Lawrence, all at once intolerably excited, his eyes fixed on the piece of paper in Agustin's hand. The two halves of the address in Paris. Part 3. Agustin Marchand kept a diary in those days, a lock diary written in cipher, and for more than a month after Lawrence Story's visit, the tenor of the entries there was almost identical. No change, always with me. How much longer can I endure it? The alteration in my looks is being remarked upon to my face. I shall have to get rid of Thornton, his man, on some pretext or other, for I begin to think that he has seen it. No wonder, since it follows me about like a dog. When it is visible to everyone, it will be the end. I found it in bed with me this morning, pressed up against me, as if for warmth. But there was a different class of entry also appearing at intervals with an ever-increasing note of impatience. Will L.S. go there? When shall I hear from L.S.? Will the experiment do what I think? It is my last hope. Then suddenly, after 5 weeks had elapsed, an entry in a trembling hand. For 24 hours, I have seen no sign of it. Can it be possible? And next day, still nothing. I began to live again. This evening has just come in an ecstatic from L.S. from Paris, telling me he has presented his credentials and was to the experience next day. He has had it by now, by yesterday, in fact. Have I really freed myself? It looks like it. In 1 week from the date of that last entry, it was remarked in Abbott's meeting how much better Mr. Marchand was looking again. Of late, he had not seemed at all himself. His cheeks had fallen in, his clothes seemed to hang loosely upon him, who had generally filled them so well, and he appeared nervous. Now he was as before, cheery, courtly, debonair. And last Sunday, will you believe it, he went to church. The rector was so astonished when he first became aware of him from the pulpit that he nearly forgot to give out his text, and the poet joined in the hymn. Several observed this amazing phenomena. It was the day after his unwonted appearance at St. Peter's. Augustine was strolling in his garden. The air had a new savor, the sun a new light. He could look again with pleasure at Thetis and her nymphs of the fountain, could work undisturbed in the summer house. Free, free! All the world was too good to the senses once again, and the hues and scents of early autumn better, in truth, than the brilliance of that summer month, which had seen his curse descend upon him. The butler brought him out a letter with a French stamp, from Lawrence Story, of course, to tell him what. Where had he caught his first glimpse of it? In one of those oppressively furnished French bedrooms? And how had he taken it? At first, however, Agustin was not sure that the letter was from Story. The writing was very different, cramped instead of flowing, and in places spluttering, the pen having dug into the paper as if the hand which held it had not been entirely under control. Almost, thought Agustin, his eyes shining with excitement, almost as though something had been twined liana-like round the wrist. He had a sudden sick recollection of a day when that had happened to him, quickly submerged in a gush of eager anticipation. Sitting down upon the edge of the fountain, he read, not quite what he had looked for. I don't know what is happening to me, began the letter, without other opening. Yesterday, I was in a cafe by myself, and I just ordered some absinthe, though I do not like it. And quite suddenly, although I knew that I was in the cafe, I realized that I was also back in that room. I could see every feature of it, but I could see the cafe too, with all the people in it. The one was, as it were, superimposed upon the other. The room, which was a good deal smaller than the cafe, being inside the latter, as a box may be within a larger box, and all the while the room was growing clearer, that cafe fading. I saw the glass of absinthe suddenly standing on nothing, as it were. All the furniture of the room, all the accessories you know of, were mixed up with the chairs and tables of the cafe. I do not know how I managed to find my way to the comptoir, pay, and get out. I took a fiacre back to my hotel. By the time I arrived there, I was all right. I suppose that it was only the after effects of a very strange and violent emotional experience, but I hope to God that it will not recur. How interesting, said Augustin Marchant, dabbing his hand in the swirling water where he had once drowned a piece of dark fluff. And why indeed should I have expected that it would couch at his door in the same form as mine? 4 days more of newfound peace, and he was reading this. In God's name, or the devil's, come over and help me. I have hardly an hour now by night or day when I am sure of my whereabouts. I could not risk the journey back to England alone. It is like being imprisoned in some kind of infernal, half-transparent box, always growing a little smaller. Wherever I go now, I carry it about with me. When I am in the street, I hardly know which is the pavement and which is the roadway, because I'm always treading on that black carpet with the cabalistic designs. If I speak to anyone, they may suddenly disappear from sight. To attempt to work is naturally useless. I would consult a doctor, but that would mean telling him everything. I hope to God he won't do that, muttered Augustin uneasily. He can't. He swore to absolute secrecy. I hadn't bargained, however, for his ceasing work. Suppose he finds himself unable to complete the design for Theodora Marozia. That would be serious. However, to have freed myself is worth any sacrifice. But story cannot obviously go on living indefinitely on two planes at once. Artistically, though, it might inspire him to something quite unprecedented. I'll write to him and point that out. It might encourage him. But go near him in person? Is it likely? The next day was one of great literary activity. Augustin was so deeply immersed in his new poetical drama that he neglected his correspondence and almost his meals except his dinner, which seemed that evening to be shared most agreeably and excitingly by these new creations of his brain. Such, in fact, was his preoccupation with them that it was not until he had finished the savory and poured out a glass of his superlative port that he remembered a telegram which had been handed to him as he came in to dinner. It still lay unopened by his plate. Not tearing it apart, the envelope he read with growing bewilderment these words above his publisher's name. Please inform us immediately what steps to take. Are prepared. Send to France. Recover drawings, if possible. What suggestions can you make as to successor, Russell and Ward? Augustin was more than bewildered. He was stupefied. Had some accident befallen Lauren's story, of which he knew nothing? But he had opened all his letters this morning, though he had not answered any. A prey to a sudden, very nasty anxiety, he got up and rang the bell. Burroughs, bring the Times from the library. The newspaper came unopened. Augustin, now in a frenzy of uneasiness, scanned the pages rapidly, but it was some seconds before he came upon the headline, Tragic Death of a Young English Artist, and read the following furnished by the Paris correspondent. Connoisseurs who were looking forward to the appearance of the superb illustrated edition of Mr. Augustin Marchant's Queen Theodora and Queen Marozia will learn with great regret of the death by drowning of the gifted young artist Mr. Lawrence Story, who was engaged upon the designs for it. Mr. Story had recently been staying in Paris, but left one day last week for a remote spot in Brittany. It was supposed in pursuance of his work. On Friday last, his body was discovered floating in a lonely pool near Carhaix. It is hard to see how Mr. Story could have fallen in, since this piece of water, the mare, the Plougouvan, has a completely level shore surrounded by reeds, and is not in itself very deep, nor is there any boat upon it. It is said that the unfortunate young Englishman had been somewhat strange in his manner recently, and complained of hallucinations. It is therefore possible that under their influence he deliberately waded out into the Mar de Plougouvan. A strange feature of the case is that he had fastened around him, under his coat, the finished drawings from Mr. Marchand's book, which were of course completely spoiled by the water before the body was found. It is to be hoped that they were not the only. Augustin threw the Times furiously away from him and struck the dinner table with his clenched fist. "'Pon my soul, that is too much. It is criminal. My property, and I who had done so much for him, fastened them around himself? He must have been crazy.' But had he been so crazy? When his wrath had subsided a little, Augustin could not but ask himself whether the young artist had not, in some awful moment of insight, guessed the truth, or a part of it, that his patron had deliberately corrupted him. It looked almost like it. But if he had really taken all the finished drawings with him to this place in Brittany, what an unspeakably mean trick of revenge thus to destroy them. Yet, even if it were so, he must regard their loss as the price of his own deliverance, since from his point of view, the desperate expedient of passing on his familiar had been a complete success. By getting someone else to plunge even deeper than he had done into the unlawful, for he had seen to it that Lawrence Story should do that, he had proved, as that verse in Genesis said, that he had rule over what had pursued him in tangible form as a consequence of his own night in Prague. He could not be too thankful. The literary world might well be thankful too, for his own art was of infinitely more importance than subservient, the parasitic art of an illustrator. He could with a little search find half a dozen just as gifted as that poor hallucination-ridden story to finish Theodora and Marozia, even if necessary to begin an entirely fresh set of drawings. And meanwhile, in the new lease of creative energy, which this unfortunate but necessary sacrifice had made possible for him, he would begin to put in paper the masterpiece which was now taking brilliant shape in his liberated mind. A final glass, and then an evening in the workshop. Augustin poured out some port and was raising the glass, prepared to drink to his own success, when he thought he heard a sound near the door. He looked over his shoulder. Next instant, the stem of the wine glass had snapped in his hand, and he had sprung back to the farthest limit of the room. Reared out for quite 5 feet against the door, huge, dark, sleeked with wet and flecked with bits of green water weed, was something half python, half gigantic cobra, its head drawn back as if to strike. Its head, for in its former featureless tapering end, were now two reddish eyes, such as furriers put into the heads of stuffed creatures, and they were fixed in an unwavering and malevolent glare upon him as he cowered there, clutching the bowl of the broken wine glass, the crumpled copy of the Times lying at his feet.